Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to the IC's Companies and Market Show. My name is Julian Hoffman. I'm Deputy Companies Editor here at the IC. And this week I'm stepping into Dan Jones's capacious but essentially mid-market shoes to deliver the best in analysis of the week's corporate events. My partners in corporate crime this week, figuratively speaking, is Mark Robinson, our company's editor and elder statesman. Hank, how are you, Mark?
Very well, thank you, Julian. I'm just giving some further thought to Dan Jones's footwear.
Excellent. Joining us also with expert analysis is our investment writer, Gemma Slingo. Hi, Gemma, how are you?
Hi, Julian. I'm well, thank you.
Good. And talking about the feature this week, which is going to be our SIP special, is Val Cipriani. Hi, Val, how are you?
Hi, Julian. Well, thank you.
This week has been an interesting one for investors. The main worry overhanging the markets is whether the US is about to default on its debt for the first time in its history. So far, as we record, there's been no agreement on raising the debt ceiling. And the worry of this is starting to weigh heavily on thoughts both here and on the other side of the Atlantic. What do you think of this, Mark? Do you reckon that they're going to be stupid enough to not pay their debts, as it were?
I would be very surprised if they didn't raise it. I mean, I think they've done it 78 times in the past, so it's not a one-off in that regard. But I think the Republican Party are approaching this just as a matter of highlighting how out of control public spending is in the United States at the moment. We're in a not dissimilar situation over here, but of course, the dollar is the world's primary reserve currency. Has greater implications across the board. I'd be very surprised if they don't come to some accommodation, because I don't think the Republicans are asking that much, really, in terms of reducing the rate of growth of spending without actually reducing spending per se.
Yeah, so you think they'll blink at the last minute and just do a deal like they always do?
I imagine so, if for no other reason than it's political expediency, really. It won't look good for Biden if they don't come to some sort of accommodation.
No, I noticed that his approval ratings are not great at the moment, so there must be an incentive to settle, I would have thought.
Yeah, I should think so. I don't know if he's altogether that aware of his approval ratings at the moment, or any other, you know, cognitive issues.
Generally not aware.
Just generally not aware. It's an extraordinary position, and of course, you know, the primary season has kicked off, or is going to kick off now that Ron DeSantis is throwing his hat in the ring. So we can look forward to 15 months of US political analysis.
Excellent. So the other news we had this week was that Ocado, one time darling of the market, but now much unloved, is about to be demoted from the FTSE 100. We'll turn to Ocado a little bit later in the podcast, because it's links up with our result of the week, which is going to be M&S. And luckily, talking about M&S today, we have Gemma, who wrote the story on the company. It was quite a performance, wasn't it, from M&S's shares? What do you put that down to?
Yeah, I think everyone was pleasantly surprised, actually. It must be said, and as you mentioned, the shares really got a boost on the morning of the results. I think there were quite a few forces at play, but on an absolute basic level, basically food and clothing sales kept growing, even though people didn't really think they would. And that meant even while operating profit did fall year on year, because there was this business rates relief in the earlier period, analyst expectations were surpassed by quite a sizable amount. And I think sort of the main question you have to ask is, how did M&S keep attracting customers during such a well-publicised cost of living crunch? And it sort of made an interesting point in relation to food, because obviously we think of M&S is quite a luxurious food supplier. It has all the sort of opulent adverts, but it actually made real efforts to try and keep prices reasonable for customers, which hurt its gross margins in the short term, particularly in the first half of the year. But actually, it meant customers kept coming back, kept buying large volumes, and that really pushed the sales through in the second half. So it seemed to pay off.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's all about footfall in retail, isn't it? I mean, you, unlike the rest of us, have actually been into an M&S store recently. I mean, how do you rate the offering from a consumer point of view?
Yeah, I went into the flagship Marble Arch one last weekend, and actually it did strike me as quite a good offering. And management mentioned in its results that style perceptions had improved at the company, because there's been this question for ages about whether people actually want to buy M&S's clothes, whether cost of living crisis or not, whether they're actually fashionable and in demand. And I think that has improved. But I guess the question is whether it can achieve change over the long term or whether it's been sort of a seasonal shift that might drift back.
Famously frumpy, isn't it? I think they kind of sort of really characterised as.
I just might employ a little bit of a scuttlebutt here as well, because there is a M&S quite close to me where I live. And I do go on occasionally. It's just the food aspect. But the most noticeable thing since probably, well, I would say midway through last year, actually, is the number of own brand generic products that are in the store now. The packaging is very plain, very simple. And so it's obvious that they've sort of changed that market dynamic to a large degree. They're targeting an adjusted operating margin of about 4% within the next 5 years. So it would be interesting to see when this inflationary period moderates to a certain degree, where they are in terms of that margin pursuit as well, because they're moving to the area. You look at all the main food retailers, Sainsbury's, Tesco and so on, and what connects all of them are these sort of painfully and understandably thin net margins too. So they could well be heading down that road. Hence, the shareholders can be pleased by that fairly marked increase in market share, albeit from a fairly lowly base.
It's an interesting point because they do have this Remarksable Value food line now, which is basically the unbranded basic food products, which has been luring lots of people in. But then on the other side of the spectrum, in the clothing department, they've brought in higher, sort of, I guess, more expensive brands and formed partnerships with fancier brands aimed at wealthier customers, which I think is trying to bring in a different customer base to its fashion department. So it seems to be operating at both ends of the spectrum at the moment, and it does seem to be working quite well.
That is an interesting point. I can remember as a former M&S employee 20 years ago that the lines weren't particularly innovative, were they? So they're obviously making an effort to get a higher spending clientele. And I remember working on the customer service desk and finding it incredibly embarrassing because basically over the Christmas period I worked there, I essentially refunded the underwear of everyone I knew in the district, including the vicar's wife, which I don't know, it took me years to get over that trauma. But it is definitely a sense that they have outsourced and brought in more expertise, isn't it, as far as from what you're saying?
I think so. And it's almost like you see shops like John Lewis struggling, and Marks and Spencer's almost seems to be wanting to encroach in that territory. It's brought in partnerships with the likes of Hobbs and White Stuff, where the average cost of a garment would be higher. So it's, yeah, as I said, trying to get a bit of a different clientele, I think.
How would you rate the shares, though, in terms of, I mean, is it now still worth buying in? Or what was your take on the value that they represent for shareholders?
I think there's still a question over its growth prospects, and that seemed to be the general thoughts among analysts as well. So are we convinced that the latest results represent a real turning point and that from now on M&S can grow, or is it a bit of a short-term boom really? And I think ultimately it's up to investors to decide whether they're convinced of the strategy, but at the moment I'm not fully convinced that we'll be seeing great growth going forwards.
No, that's interesting. I mean, obviously, M&S is one of the biggest single retail investor holding, isn't it, on the market because of the way they structured their employee reward scheme. So it's obviously very relevant to how many of our readers will look at the shares, isn't it, from that point of view?
Yeah, and I think one of the big things to consider is its store portfolio. So for ages, it's been trying to wriggle out of these legacy assets, often on high streets, which aren't getting the footfall that they used to. And moving more to retail parks and these big flagship city centre stores. And I imagine that will be quite an expensive process, which might restrict cash flow going forwards, I think.
Okay. Just moving on to the next point. Did they mention much about their joint venture with Ocado in the results? That seems to have disappeared off the headlines for the company. Is that something you noticed?
It's buried quite deep. They mentioned that so the group's partnership with Ocado resulted in a net loss of £29.5 million in the latest period, and that was compared to an almost £14 million net profit the year before that. And there seems to be this sense that pandemic shopping habits are reversing, cost inflation is causing issues with margins. And analysts at Barclays expect these losses sort of to continue for the next couple of years. So I reckon shareholders might be getting a bit uneasy, because it seemed to be that the tie-up with Ocado was expensive to start with, and now it's like the company is being tied into its losses as things deteriorate. So I don't think that's going to be massively popular, really.
Well, because M&S has to pay, isn't it, that if they want to buy Ocado out of the joint venture, it's something like 156 million, isn't it, that it's valued at. I mean, that sounds, these days, that sounds like a bit of an ambitious valuation, given that Ocado itself is struggling. And let's just bring in Mark on that. I mean, you and I were both grey-haired when Ocado listed on the market in 2010, and I think Gemma was in year nine at the time. But how do you view that company on as a standalone? Is it kind of shot its bolt as a concept? I mean, how, what's your general view of the arc of Ocado, as it were?
Well, I never actually covered the company personally through that period, so I'm having to go on sort of comments by some of our erstwhile colleagues. It was always a case of jam tomorrow with Ocado, I think, and it could be one of these cases as well where first mover advantage was anything but as well, because they've had to endure a lot of development costs down through the years. Leverage has been a major problem for the company. And there was a problem during the pandemic itself, which was obviously a very positive period on the face of it for online retail. But and the problem there was is that they couldn't scale up the business model quickly enough to take advantage of the demand. And as Gemma mentioned, now that sort of dynamic has pulled back and may even be shrinking to a certain degree. So now they've got they've got excess capacity to deal with. You know, it's hardly surprising that M&S had sort of buried mention of the arrangement. I think they're also on the hook, or M&S could also be on the hook for further financing arrangements under the joint venture too. So, you know, I think it's just, as I mentioned before, I think it's just one of these classic examples of a first mover advantage actually being something of a disadvantage.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it seems like it was always a very difficult business to get up to speed, wasn't it? You know, you had to, you know, invest vast amounts of money in these warehouses, the oldest of which they're now having to close because of too much capacity, as you said. But it's just not a scalable business, is it? You know, instead of just employing people to work in a shop when you need them, you kind of have to use loads of computer programmers and robots. And 5 years down the line, you've got a warehouse. Is that right.
No problem. Yeah. It was always for a long time. It was always rated as a tech stock as well. So I just wonder how many shareholders have bought in at the sort of elevated positions before, and now it's just left high and dry because of it. You have to have a certain amount of sympathy for any business like this, because they've made mistakes that rivals in the market don't have to make, because they've taken on that burden already.
Yes, that's true, isn't it? I mean, obviously, as you said, the first mover can be an advantage, but if your technology is at a slight angle, you're stuck with all the costs then, aren't you, and none of the benefits.
Yes, that's true.
Our feature this week is our annual SIP special, where our expert personal finance team is looking at the best ways to use and invest your SIP. And with me today to discuss it is our personal finance writer, Val Cipriani.
Thank you, Julian. Hi.
Nice to see you. So let's have a look at the context of the SIP special. So what's the idea behind it? How are investors going to find this useful? Let's start off with that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it covers a few different things of how you deal with your self-invested personal pension. You know, going from the more kind of financial planning side of things. So, you know, what strategy you might use to try and make sure that, you know, your SIP matches what you needed to do, which is, you know, presumably give you a decent amount of income in retirement. And then it also covers the more, if you want, investment side of things. So, you know, the strategies you might want to deploy and the kind of assets you might want to have in your SIP. So it's quite a broad ranging sort of issue. And it also looks at, you know, the platforms, so which providers you might want to use to build your SIP, which are the best, and depending on your circumstances. So quite a few different things.
So what have you looked at specifically? Well, I mean, are there certain things that investors need to do just before they retire, just to, you know, to get ready to put the SIP together? What things have you discovered there?
Yeah, so it's one of the things I've looked at. And I think, you know, as you approach retirement, there are really a lot of things to think about. But I think two key aspects here that I sort of wanted to raise. The first one is, you know, what do you do with your investment strategy, whether you change it or not? And the second one, how much income is a safe level of income to make sure that, you know, you've got money to go on until you need it, you know, because retirement is quite a long period of time, actually.
And it's getting longer, isn't it, all the time?
Yeah, getting longer all the time. So, you know, for example, got some data here, but between 2018 and 2020, the most common age of death in the UK was 86.7 years for men and 89.3 years for women. So this obviously, you know, it's not the average life expectancy. So it doesn't really take into account, you know, more people that sometimes die young. But it does tell you something about, you know, after you get to a certain age, actually how long are you likely to live. So if you retire at 65, that is, you know, 20 plus years that you need to think about. So it's quite a long period of time, actually.
What's the best way to plan for it? Have you been looking at certain asset classes, or what ideas have you come up with on team there that you could put in a SIP that sort of matches that time frame?
Yeah, I think the first point, you know, in terms of the de-risking aspect, the message that you get from financial planners is very much, you know, be careful not to de-risk too much. Because as you get to retirement, it's, you know, it is true that you're going to need some cash, because obviously you're going to need to draw income from your SIP. But as we said, the time horizon is actually still quite long. So one thing that was told to me was that you can kind of choose a bucket approach where you have, you know, like a big chunk of your portfolio that is actually still quite, you know, fairly growth focused with quite a bit of equity in there. And then you can have like a smaller pot that is basically cash. And, you know, we're talking about a significantly smaller pot, like, you know, about 1 year worth of income. And, you know, that bit is about making sure that you sort of smooth out the volatility a little bit. Because obviously, you know, markets go up and down a lot. And if you need the income from your investments, you want to get it you want to sell assets at a time where the markets are not down too much. So that's what that bucket of cash is there for. But then for the bulk of your investments, you still want to think quite long term. And, you know, there is a conversation to be had in terms of income and growth assets and how you balance those, basically. Because on one hand, you can have, you know, if ideally you can just draw income from your assets that you don't spend your capital, and your pension funds could potentially last forever. Mm. But on the other hand, that is not obviously going to work for everybody, because, well, first of all, you need a really big pot to just draw income from it. And second, there's conversations to be had in terms of how diversified that approach is.
Have you been looking at investment trusts at all as part of that conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. So investment trusts, you know, they tend to be pretty solid holdings for a pension for a few reasons. Obviously, you know, it depends on the strategy and on the trust. But there's a few things to be said there. One of them is that quite a few investment trusts, you know, they're quite reliable in terms of income, you know, all the dividend heroes conversation. So that means that, you know, even if markets go up and down, there are some investment trusts that will give you a reliable income and have been doing so for a number of years. So that definitely helps in a pension. And then a second point on that note is that investment trusts also give you access to asset classes that are not as readily available, such as, you know, alternatives, so infrastructure, for example, or private equity, if you want to have that. And again, for example, infrastructure trusts do pay a fairly decent level of yield. So if that's what you're interested in, you can find it there. And then the third point is that they do tend to, like, investment trusts are obviously qualify as shares, like company shares, not as open-ended funds. So that means that in some platforms, they will be cheaper to hold than open-ended funds. So obviously costs are a big factor to think about. And I'm sure a lot of investors like holding them for that reason as well.
Well, of course, it can affect your overall performance, isn't it? If you leave the costs unchecked, it tends to eat away at your income in the long run, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think, you know, we do know that, but when you do the maths of the kind of like difference that half a percentage point in fees makes over 20 years of investing a portfolio, you really find it quite shocking. Even if you did know that it was going to be a big figure, it's usually bigger than you thought at the beginning. So definitely something to think about. Yeah, and I mean, in the magazine, my colleague Dave Baxter has looked into some of the top performing investment trusts. So there's a nice table there that looks at those that have returned more than 1,000% in the decade to May 2023, basically. So that's also an interesting one from more of a growth point of view, because obviously there's quite aggressive asset classes there. You know, a lot of smaller companies, for example, smaller companies trusts, some tech trusts and all of that. But yeah, it's quite interesting to look at. And, you know, if you do like the growth approach more than the income approach, obviously, you know, you have to have quite a long term focus. But if you're patient and you keep adding to your SIP, you can get some fairly good trusts at a fairly good discount when the markets are not good like now.
Exactly. Perfect. Well, Val, thank you very much for taking us through that. We all look forward to reading that this week. Obviously, listeners, you can pick up your own copy of the Investors Chronicles SIP guide when that comes out, available in all good retailers. Anyway, it just remains for me to thank Val, Mark, and Gemma for their contribution, and we look forward to speaking to you again next week.